From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The teenage survivors of the Parkland, Florida gun massacre are going strong nearly 2 weeks after 17 of their fellow students and school staff were gunned down. Their urgent and unequivocal call for gun control has been met with opposition from the far right, including the NRA and President Trump. But by and large, the American public has embraced the courage and conviction of these kids. And celebrities like George Clooney and Oprah Winfrey have offered both emotional and, more importantly, financial support. Now, some who have been involved with Black Lives Matter have asked, why is it that when Black teenagers mobilized some years ago to protest the rampant police killings and gun violence in their community, they did not receive such broad support? Janaya Khan, writing in The Root, expressed her pain at these double standards, saying, this moment serves to remind Black youths that the world cares less about them than it does other children. Joining me to explore these issues is Chenjerai Kumanyika, an assistant professor in the Rutgers University Department of Journalism and Media Studies and a regular news correspondent for our program. Welcome to the program, Chenjerai.
Thank you. So good to be on one of my favorite programs.
Thank you so much, Chenjerai. We love having you on too. Let's talk first about the importance of what these young folks from Parkland have been doing and why all of us ought to welcome it, no matter what our background. How important, how heartened have you been to see their call against gun violence, their call for gun control actually being taken seriously?
I mean, I think that their leadership and their courage on this issue is really profound and inspiring. I think that, you know, I mean, you just think about the trauma that they're also going through at this moment, but for them to channel that into a really progressive and productive pressure and conversation about what needs to happen is encouraging. And I think that there's historical precedent for, you know, youth engaging in this way, really lighting fire to a social movement.
So the issue of gun violence is not new, obviously. Sometimes we've sort of waited for the tipping point. It might be that the Parkland massacre has been or is going to be that tipping point where we finally say, all right, this is one too many. But the issue of gun violence, and not just gun violence from vigilantes and from, you know, crazy people with guns, but from police themselves, has been a huge issue disproportionately affecting the Black community. And we did see the banner of Black Lives Matter, the call that Black Lives Matter a few years ago burst into the scene. And we did see it be taken very seriously. Progressives have taken it seriously. On this program, we consider it one of the most important movements. But still, by and large, not enough liberals seem to take Black Lives Matter seriously. What do you think?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, I think that there's a tendency in, you know, American liberalism to want to see all of the problems that plague us as aberrations. You know, Trump is an aberration. He's something different than America. Gun violence is our aberrations. Any particular police corruption or something like that, aberrations. And I think what the leadership in Black Lives Matter has been very good at doing is to remind us that these things are very deeply baked into American institutions, like the police, like all the forces that are unifying around a kind of gun fundamentalism. And that, you know, and I think that they, and so the, and so in that vein, right, people look at the shootings that happened and the things, the events in Ferguson or, you know, the other places where, the, you know, Trayvon Martin, and they may look at the Parkland thing and say those are two very different things. But I think a Black Lives Matter analysis says, no, those things are part of larger and violence baked into the structure of American institutions.
I think that is a really critical issue. So we might think that the Parkland students are the first major uprising among young folks in the past decade to be calling attention to gun violence. But how have Black youth been calling attention to the issue of gun violence, not just police violence, but gun violence in general?
Right. I mean, so, you know, yes, going back even, you know, before you had the Black Lives Matter movement focusing on police and state violence, you've had all kinds of initiatives in various places in the country where people are trying to come to terms with the deep roots of the intrapersonal violence in their communities. often, finding ways to intervene in that on the personal level, but ultimately tying that to the deep structural inequality and poverty. Because if we know that if we put those maps where violence happens, whether it's in black or white neighborhoods, over the maps where there's joblessness and where there's been a deep and deep, a divestment in public goods, what we see is that those maps match pretty closely. So I think that the Black Lives Matter, the youth have been at the forefront of that. And then, of course, when it comes to state violence, starting really, they're continuing a legacy. It's really important because there's a long legacy of resistance to police violence going back from the Black Panther Party, going back through the December 12th movement. And the Black Lives Matter has picked up on that and really, caused people to really think differently about these issues. But it's weird because, again, the ways that the victims themselves of some of these police killings are often criminalized, and then the groups that mobilize around them, there's a way in which America often doesn't look at those black movements as like a heartening, inspiring youth movement, right? It's like almost like they're not youth, but in fact, there were a lot of young people in the leadership of this.
Now, I had quoted Jenaya Khan's piece, and that piece in particular in The Root really moved me. Even her headline, and I think this is really important for us to face her. The article was entitled "Why It Hurts When the World Loves Everyone But Us," and it made me cry, frankly, to see that piece because that is a really important question. That when we see claims, demands, calling of attention to ills from black folks, the country doesn't want to look at it or take it seriously. And is that why, just picking up what you were saying earlier, that if we are to take these issues seriously, all of a sudden we have to take very seriously the crimes on which this very country was founded?
That's right. We really do. And I think for that reason, black movements of resistance are not very popular. But I've been looking at Kyangi Yamada Taylor wrote a wonderful analysis of this for Socialist Worker, and she kind of draws some connections between the Parkland students and the students in the Black Lives Matter movement. She says that the Black Lives Matter youth were sort of engaged by Obama's election and kind of fired up, and they had kind of the moment that the Parkland students are having now, something similar in this, in the sense of hope and engagement, involvement with the political system. And of course, they were disappointed when they saw Obama's failure to deal with Wall Street, and sort of destroying what's going to be the future of their jobs, of affordable housing, and also the failure to really engage significantly on police violence and as well as the imperialism, right? And so that then has moved many of those youth into a more radical position, right? And the Parkland youth were likewise engaged by this mass shooting and the spate of mass shootings, primarily the one that happened, at their own school. But now, as they watch, one, the GOP not be able to, taking this really strong, callous gun fundamentalist position, and then they see the sort of impotence of Democrats to even properly analyze the problem or do anything about it. I get the sense that some of them are also being radicalized. So I think we have to look at those common strains and think about how those forces can come together in a radical social movement.
And it's very possible that the young folks who are in the leadership of the call against gun violence, who are the survivors of Parkland, may be strong supporters of Black Lives Matter. We don't really know because they have grown up in a time when young folks are more exposed to issues like police violence, may take it more seriously, and we can only hope that their analysis extends to seeing gun violence as seeing how gun violence disproportionately impacts Black communities and finding common cause and taking up a common struggle with groups that are already working on this issue.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And so I think that the calls that Jenaya Khan and I saw Patrice Cullors also make this point about the different responses people have had to these youth movements, I think those are important and right. But we have to be careful because there is sometimes a move that people make where they then try to pit the groups against each other or just move into a overall move that's basically like none of these white people care about us. And I don't know that that's true. I think that the media certainly, I think, often has a certain kind of investment in characterizing black youth movements and black movements a particular way. Certain government and corporate actors may, but I have some belief in these Parkland youth. And I think that this is also where we on the left, I think our role is to, I mean, you talked about, you know, the hope that these, that, you know, what's going to happen from this moment. I think that we have to be active in our hope, and we really have to embrace this movement, support it, get involved with it, and make sure that it doesn't end, that they don't, that the hope isn't just sort of snuffed out by politics as usual.
And one of the critiques that that liberals had made of Black Lives Matter is that there aren't clear leaders, etc. And of course, there are, even if they don't want to see themselves as leaders. The three founders of Black Lives Matter, Patrice Cullors, Opal Tometi, Alicia Garza, were certainly leaders in the movement. But what I really have loved about folks involved in Black Lives Matter is many folks have said this is not a leaderless movement, it's a leaderful movement. Everyone's a leader. But also, we have seen historically, right, Chenjerai, that Black leaders have been personally targeted historically by the government. It has not been easy to be a militant Black leader because you might get gunned down, you will be surveilled, you will be undermined at every turn, you might get framed for a crime you didn't commit. That history weighs heavy.
That's right. Yes, it really does. It weighs heavy. And I mean, in fact, right, when we look at the Reagan era and that particular phase, you know, which is a key phase of the conversation about gun control, we see that the conversation about gun control in this country really emerges in response to the Black Panther Party, right? So, you know, their concern, suddenly Black men with guns and Black people with guns in that party trying to remedy their communities, trying to offer, you know, breakfast programs, but also to think about how they can take control of local electoral politics. Suddenly that's like, okay, we have to do something about guns, you know? So.
And of course, unfortunately, the Parkland survivors are finding that they are now being targeted themselves. And this is very sad. We've seen, just because they've been so effective at marshaling support for gun control, NRA members and others who, I like the term you use, gun fundamentalists, are sending them death threats. So in some ways, unfortunately, they're experiencing what other leaders, in particular Black leaders, have faced in the past, where you get death threats when you're effective.
That's right. Yeah. It's, I mean, and I think that that shows you the real violent sensibility behind this whole gun movement, this, what Danny Ketch calls this connective tissue that ties together the NRA and the Republican Party, as well as, you know, the 5 million people who are, 5 million sounds like a big number, but when you think about the overwhelming majority of Americans who don't support the current lack of gun control legislation, right, then you see this small number of people through this organization, you know, kind of wielding control, and you see the violent nature behind it when you see some of these people threatening students who are trying to solve the problem.
Let's also talk about something that we don't hear enough of, which is that the proliferation of guns in this country is very much linked to race and gender. Some have brought up the history of the Second Amendment as being related to the end of slavery and slave catchers wanting to have the right to their arms. I wrote in Truth Dig last week about how it's important for us to understand that the majority of NRA supporters who have the most conservative positions are white men without a college education. Incidentally, the biggest demographic that voted for Donald Trump. And they see this fight for gun control as a deeply racialized fight, even if they don't admit it outright, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And so I think that, you know, certainly the people who are victims of various kinds of gun violence are often African Americans. When it comes to the police killing people, which we have to include in as a part of this conversation, right? You know, they're overwhelmingly Black. I think women, I mean, we can maybe talk more about this later, but I think that it's weird because on one hand, Black, you know, people of color and women are on the receiving end of a lot of this gun violence.
Right. There's a huge correlation between, I believe, domestic violence and mass shooters tend to be more likely to have had a background of domestic violence.
Absolutely. I mean, I think I saw something that, you know, essentially the presence of a gun in domestic violence situation increases the risk of homicide for women by 500%.
Wow.
So I think that what you see when you look at that is the even more reason why we can begin to pull these different groups together into a movement against this, what Danny Katch calls gun fundamentalism, right? This idea that guns are the key right that that they're going to mobilize behind at any cost. And I think that that has to be attacked. I mean, I agree. I think that that's something that does have to be attacked. We need a cultural movement in part. I mean, there's laws that have to be challenged, but that culture has to be challenged because there's a lot of people who do believe this. And like you said, there's racial ideology connected to it and all these other things. But there's a lot, I think there's, you know, a lot more Americans who are really ready to change this. But it's complicated on the left, right?
And I don't want to get to that, but staying on this issue of race in particular, in many ways, one of the calls that we should be seeing coming out of this massacre is for Black Lives to Matter, because, and not enough is being made of this, the confessed shooter, Nicholas Cruz, was found to have engaged in extremely racist language, used extremely racist language in an online forum. He was part of an Instagram group in which racism was a constant theme, as per an article that CNN posted. And in that, Cruz wrote that he hated Jews, used the N-word, immigrants, talked about killing Mexicans, keeping Black people in chains, and cutting their necks. Now, if we were to reverse that, if this shooter was a person of color talking about white people in these violent ways, that would have been the focus, not just of NRA people and the right, but of the media as well. We've seen this aspect of the Parkland massacre kind of disappear into the ether, haven't we?
That's right. Yeah, no, I mean, it's this aspect, you're so right. I mean, that came out. And even when it came out, I never really became front and center as a story in the way. But if you think about, for example, in, I think it was in Dallas where someone shot several police, right?
There was an African-American man who shot
police. African-American man who shot police. The first image we see of him, he's in a dashiki. Immediately, they're looking at him ideologically.
Yeah.
It takes a while for him, you know, his military background to come out, right? You know, in so many of these cases. And I think that, you know, but here we're unable to understand this person as motivated by white supremacy. So I think that's, and you know, there's so many of these killings, that's a common thread. Mm-hmm. And we have a president who refers to people who attend white supremacist gatherings as very nice people.
Chenjerai, we talked earlier about how not enough, about the hypocrisy around Black Lives Matter and the Parkland victims, Parkland survivors. But what do you make of the left response to, the response among progressives to what's come up after Parkland?
Well, you know, I think it's been, I think there's a lot of frustration. And I think that, you know, again, you know, I want to give credit to people like Kyung Yamada Taylor, Danny Katch, who are really thinking a way forward for the left. And I think they point out that there's a lot of reasons, good reasons, why people on the left are concerned about some of the solutions that are being proposed. Everybody knows this is out of control. Everybody knows something has to be done. But, you know, when you get into some of the things that have to do with background checks and some of these things, often that translates into criminalization of people of color and really just harmful things. Like anything, you know, you really, anytime you're talking about empowering police with more funds or more or less oversight, or, you know, you have to be careful, I think. So, I mean, I think we're at a moment where I'm not saying let's throw out background checks. And I don't think anybody on the left is saying that, but I think that's one issue. And I think the other issue that's really tricky for people on the left is, you just mentioned that, you know, there's a long history of law enforcement and others targeting Black people, targeting women. We just saw an instance of somebody who was a white supremacist targeting, you know, he just killed people in his school, but had seemed like he had the intention to target brown folks. We also see the FBI targeting, while this guy is killing people, you know, and is a white supremacist, we have the FBI worried about Black identity extremists. So I was in Charlottesville And in all those, when you, if you think about all those things together, there's a, we have to be able to talk about some way of thinking about self-defense as a right, you know. Even if we're committed to nonviolent resistance, we have to talk about the right to self-defense. So I think that makes gun control complicated for people on the left, even though I think that ultimately all the progressives and radicals I know are believe we can get to a much better solution than where we're at now.
So the among the solutions that some, you know, that are coming out of the Parkland massacre that we're seeing is more arming of guards, police, you know, campus police, marshals, etc. But then also, of course, the really ludicrous one, which is of teachers. And isn't it true that after the Columbine massacre, all those years ago, that we did start putting armed, the ways the country did start arming campus police. This idea of campus police became a thing at public schools. And yet, in all of the years since Columbine, I don't recall hearing of a single instance where a campus police officer actually stopped a shooter, an active shooter on campus. But we have heard of arrests of students, largely sort of disciplinary actions, disproportionately impacting students of color. So the solution that that some are backing is also racialized, just as the shooting itself and the culture of gun violence is racialized.
That's right. You know, I think when you put officers with what they have like the euphemism school resource officers or whatever name they want to give to police in schools, armed police in schools, young people get hurt disproportionately, brown people, and I think even and often and quite a few women as well are subjected to this too. I witnessed this in South Carolina at Spring Valley High. But you know, she wasn't the person, you know, the young lady that was victimized wasn't shot, but she was victimized, thrown out of her chair by the police officer. So more police in schools. I mean, there's a tremendous movement right now to get police out of schools and try to get more counselors in schools. And then to think that you're going to have armed police. And we see in Parkland as well. I mean, you know, people are attacking the various. I now think there were, I've heard as many as four resource officers who were supposed to be on duty at that school, and none of them went into the building upon learning about the shooting, or
That's
at least
right.
one definitely didn't. So, and you know, I mean,
But our
it's
president said that he would have gone into the school even unarmed and tackled the shooter.
yeah, that's I think ridiculous. And I think what's, you know, equally ridiculous is the idea that we should arm teachers. And I've seen some really strong pushback from teachers who are saying, this isn't a role I want. This doesn't make sense. We know too that the even among police officers, the odds of a police officer winning in the kind of gun battle that conservatives are imagining is like extremely low for trained police officers. So now you want to put teachers in that situation. I mean, that's ridiculous. And so I think what we're it's going in precisely the wrong direction. More officers in schools, more guns, creating a more violent environment. And I think the way we direction we need to be moving is the opposite.
Right. So the problem began with the proliferation of guns, and there are now attempts to solve it with a greater proliferation of guns. But of course, what we need is to address the fact that there is so much gun proliferation. This is the heart of the issue. Do you think the Parkland survivors, those young kids who have really won so much admiration from us, are cutting, you know, seeing able to see through these very deceptive demands for more guns as a solution to safety? Are they, as far as you can tell, understanding that the only way to reduce gun violence is to reduce guns?
I mean, I would have to check to see what exactly what they're saying, but from what I could see, they're not buying it at all. And I think that what we have to hope, though, is that, you know, right now there is a sort of group of Democratic politicians and a liberal elite who's probably trying to push these students in a less radical direction, trying to tell them that we're going to make some of these small reforms here and there
And do you think that the
and.
money that George Clooney and Oprah Winfrey have promised them may actually serve to pressure them in the wrong direction?
Well, I think if we as a more, you know, leftist movement or the leftists, you know, don't embrace these youth and actually invite them into actually study the history of this problem, to study the systemic nature of this problem, to talk about why certain solutions won't work, because what the liberal elite is going to do is not that, right? Then they don't want a robust discussion to actually talk about what will work, to talk about how we can do this without increasing police repression. They don't want to engage in those discussions. And so I think we have to embrace them and invite them to study that, and essentially to, you know, nurture the idea that if they smell like something's a little fishy about this, that they're probably right.
And just going back to our original conversation, Black communities in the U.S. have known directly and firsthand, right, that the solution to violence is never more violence, because all that they've gotten from elected officials is to be tough on crime, that we're going to come into communities, guns blazing, and lock up people and throw away the key, that we're going, you know, that this idea that you can simply address so many issues born of systemic problems through guns, either in the hands of individuals or in the hands of the state, it's just not a solution. It only ends up in more innocent people dead.
That's right. We can't police it. I mean, what we're looking at right now, this particular time, this phase of late capitalism, or however you want to call it, is policing being the solution to everything, right? You know, policing is the solution to in schools. Police is the solution to homelessness. Police is the solution to migrant people who, after you've destabilized people's lives in their home countries, policing becomes a solution to that. And of course, it always ends in more repression. And I would argue it doesn't even work in the favor, really, of the workers employed as police themselves, because they're put into situations that you can't possibly manage. And they're misinformed and given the wrong kind of training too. So I think that those folks are also are victims of this actually too, even though they wind up becoming, you know, deployed by the state as perpetrators.
It seems to me that the incredible work that these young folks are doing in Parkland, that's inspiring so much around the country, really ought to be folded into existing progressive movements. We should embrace them. And I'm wondering if in the next few weeks, there are three marches that are major marches that are planned around the country, in DC, as well as in communities around the country, that it's incumbent on those of us who call ourselves progressive to show up at these marches and link these issues, right?
I think we have to link these issues, exactly. So I think now is a key time. You know, what's going to happen is there are probably going to be specific talks about particular legislation that are going to take over the narrative as the framing device. So we're going to understand, because people kind of want quick fixes, right? So if it's a particular kind of background check, then that's going to be the thing that winds up framing the discussion about gun control. And I think that we on the left have to take control of this narrative and say, no, it's not. This is about a deeper understanding of gun fundamentalism in this country. And it connects the Parkland mass shootings, which are really a tiny number of the people overall who are shot, but those mass shootings are increasing. It connects the violence against women, in which they are deeply vulnerable to being killed by domestic partners and intimate partners. It connects the killing of Black people and Black bodies by the state and through intrapersonal violence. All these things are going to be connected in our movement, and the fundamentalism and sort of belief in guns has to be attacked. And we can't let this be narrowed to this kind of incremental legislative solution. I mean, I think that there is legislation that has to be passed. For example, I think people who have been victims of shootings should be able to sue gun manufacturers. You know, I don't see a reason why we can't stop the manufacturing of AR-15s, even though that will probably in the short term lead to a tremendous increase in the purchase of AR-15s. So there's things that can happen, but I think that what we have to do is make sure that the narrative is broad and systemic and requires deep change and really becomes a campaign that can't be snuffed out by like one instance or one big spectacle.
Well, Ginger, I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us and sharing your thoughts.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And again, congratulations to all these youth, and thank you for having this conversation.
Ginger Ikomenyika is an assistant professor in the Rutgers University Department of Journalism and Media Studies and a news correspondent for our program. We've been discussing the issue of Black Lives Matter connected with the issue of gun control, as Parkland survivors are calling for. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.